You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more. Today on our show, we're talking with Amy Ione. Amy, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thanks for inviting me.
Let's talk about what you're working on now. I know you just finished a book. Can you tell me a little bit about that book, what it concerns?
Sure. It's got a kind of large title. I called it Art in the Brain, Plasticity, Embodiment, and the Unclosed Circle. And basically, just to give you a short overview, I found myself really disappointed with a lot of the conversation related to art in the brain. And what I did was I went from deep history, which is what we used to call prehistory, all the way through the present. And I looked at the communities of practice that brought people who were artists together with people who were looking at the brain. So there's a lot of different paradigms, I guess, is the way to put it, represented.
And when you said you were disappointed with the way discussions were going about art in the brain, what did you think was missing? What was happening in that dialogue, or what wasn't happening?
Well, I don't know, Brainerd, how familiar you are with some of those conversations, but a lot of scientists became familiar with, or became interested, I should say, in art in the brain, say, about 10 years ago. And so they were trying to do reductionistic models. Neuroaesthetics is a term that was often used. And as an artist, I felt that the kind of practice and intuitive involvement an artist has when making work was being lost. And so I wanted to not only speak to that, but also to the way in which artists and scientists have always explored problems together from period to period. In cultures.
Let's talk about that a little bit, because that's very interesting. I mean, there's a number of things, but that sounds like a rich topic for, you know, an entire book. As you were going through history, what did you find on early collaborations between artists and scientists? I don't hear so much about. What are some of the early collaborations that you were discussing?
Gosh, this is also historical. I find it so interesting. I hope your listeners don't find it boring. Do you know who Christopher Wren is, for example?
Yes.
Well, he's best known because he's an architect and he rebuilt London after the fire there. And before he was an architect, he had an appointment in astronomy at Oxford University. And he worked with a number of scientists, including Thomas Willis, who's the person who came up with the word neurology. And basically, they all worked together, and Christopher Wren was a part of the team. It was like a collaborative team, like you might see in a laboratory today. And so in this particular team, it was Robert Boyle and Robert Hooke and Christopher Wren and Thomas Willis and all the early founders of the Royal Society. And basically, I guess Robert Boyle was the chemist, and he figured out how to preserve the brain. So before that, they couldn't study the brain leisurely because it would all rot if they tried to look at it. So he invented chemicals. And then Robert Hooke worked with microscopes, and he figured out a way to rig up a device that aided Christopher Wren in drawing all the detail, and they also figured out how to add dyes to it. And anyway, it's just a lot of different ways of working on a project, so that they revealed a lot of things that people didn't know. And I guess you might compare it to the way people look at brain scans today, and they learn more about the brain. So they were doing the same thing, obviously, you know, in a different period.
And then
and
what
I guess
was the
when
next
you start looking, I'm sorry, go on.
No, I was going to say, what was the next? I want to hear what happens when you start looking, because so now you have artists working with scientists, but this is not about so much, we're talking about the way the brain looked. It's form to study it. Is that correct?
Well, I guess it's a combination of form, function, and creativity. And so what I became fascinated with was that everywhere I looked, I would find more things going on. So, for example, later on at the Royal Academy of Art, they had doctors who were professors of anatomy, and they would be debating with the artists about, how you should teach and methods of practice and things along those lines. And then a bunch of those artists dropped out, and they became the Pre-Raphaelites, and so they went off and formed their own school. And Darwin worked with artists when he was putting together his book on emotions and so forth and so on. So it's more like creative.
I didn't know that. Tell me that, the book on emotions that was working on with artists, because that's getting into a little more neurological territory. Right?
Yeah, well, there was a big switch insofar as how people thought, as you know, when the theory of evolution came in. And so people started to think about emotions in a different way. And Darwin wanted to use photography to help him show various emotions. And this was at the end of the 19th century. So photography had just been invented, and at that point it wasn't yet used for scientific illustration. And so what he needed to do was he needed to find photographers who could figure out how to manipulate photographs so that they could show what he wanted to show, because the technology wasn't advanced enough to just, click and shoot, or, whatever the term would be.
Right.
Shoot and click. Well, you know what I mean.
Point and shoot. Point and shoot.
So anyway, he worked with a number of photographers, as did a lot of the neurologists. Muybridge's work, you must know Muybridge.
Of course.
He got his funding for the Animal Motion book from the Department of Neurology at the University of Pennsylvania. And he and Mary did a lot of work together. Mary was a physiologist, as you probably know. And he thought Muybridge's work was really primitive. But anyway,
But Muybridge is something that almost every artist refers to now. I mean, it seems kind of an iconic body of work for a number of reasons.
Right, yeah. Well, all the neurologists were using photography for documentation, which was how they hooked him up, how he got hooked up with them. And he was an interesting character in his own right. I don't know if you know about his love affair.
Muybridge?
Yeah.
No, tell me.
He was on trial for shooting the, what was it? His wife's lover, I think it was. He caught them in bed together. And so he shot the guy and they put him on trial. And
he killed the guy?
He killed the guy, right. And so he was on trial for murder before he became a photographer. And he got off because it was blamed on a head injury. And a lot of the neurological work with artists looked at, I'm not a big fan of this work, but it looks at damaged brains. And so he got off because it was one of the early cases where they claimed insanity, due to the fact that he had a head injury.
But I don't understand that at all. He had a head injury, so that's what made him shoot his wife's lover in bed? Why would that, what would be the reason for that?
Well, there's a whole large body of research that shows that when you get head injuries, it can change your emotional makeup and how you interact with the world. And sometimes it's not really apparent that there's a problem with you other than that your personality has changed.
Well, that, you mean that's kind of like the work of Oliver Sacks, right? The late Oliver Sacks.
Yeah. It's that kind of thing. Anyway, the jury decided that whether or not he was insane, it didn't matter because anyone was justified for killing the guy in that situation. But anyway, after that happened, he became a photographer. And so, like you were saying with Oliver Sacks, there's a whole bunch of people who have some kind of neurological problem, and they might become an artist, or they might be an artist and not be an artist after they have the problem. So, yeah, that's part of what I was interested in the book.
But is the book chronicling different stories? So throughout history, of which you've told us some, but then you move forward, does the book move come all the way up to the present? Would that be someone like Oliver Sacks in the present? I mean, who?
Well,
what I'm saying is, what other is your book telling different case histories from different time periods?
Well, yes and no. I actually ended the book with Oliver Sacks, and I had a quote of his there, for months as I was working. And then he passed away the day before I sent the book to the publisher. So it was really weird. The last thing I did was change his date in the book. But basically, it includes a lot of case studies the way Oliver Sacks does, but it's more concerned with the way different communities of practice look at whatever's going on in their environment. So, for example, in the last chapter where I deal with things today, I talk about different ways in which people use art, science, and technology in relation to the brain. So do you know Marcus Novak's Allosphere or Allbrain?
Yes.
Okay, well, I talk about that project in the book as an example of a team project today that correlates with a lot of the projects I did in earlier chapters. And so from that project, I'm able to talk about things like do you know, like, the STEM-to-STEAM business?
Yeah, but we should explain some of that for the listeners who don't and who may not know Marcus Novak's work. Can you maybe explain what the collaboration was there between?
Sure. Thanks for asking. Basically, what he did was he took fMRI images of his brain while he was looking at various visuals. I believe most of it was his own work, but that's not really clear from what I read. It seemed to be some disagreement. And so it was called the Allobrain because it was designed to be looked at in an environment called the Allosphere, which is an immersive environment in which it's as if you would walk into his brain when you engage with it. And so they were saying, or some of the papers related to the project that I, you know, happened to look at in some of the films and so forth and so on, they were seeing it as a study of aesthetics from the inside, because you could actually, in effect, walk through his brain. And so because it's immersive and three-dimensional, it's a lot more like our environment than, say, obviously a drawing that Christopher Wren would have done in the brain, which is just like this flat thing of the gross anatomy rather than a brain scan of the processes at work in your brain. And because that project brings together artists and technologists and scientists and people along those lines, it's much more in line with some of the conversations today, you know, where people try and speak about collaborative work. So I guess the Olisphere, which is an environment at UC Santa Barbara in California, is funded by the National Science Foundation, and I believe it's STEM funding, which is science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. That's what the acronym STEM comes from. And some people think that art should be added to that line of research, so that rather than having STEM funding, it would be STEAM funding. And the idea is that a lot of projects that use or that are that center on science, technology, engineering, and mathematics also include artists as part of the collaborative team.
Well, it's part of the paid collaborative team.
Well, I guess that's part of the idea that that the artists get paid for this work, and some people think that that's why it should be called STEM, and that it should get funding under a STEM line of funding. Like there should be a STEM line of funding, just like there's a STEAM line of funding, just like there's a STEM line of funding.
Right. Well, I think that may be, you know, very important. I interviewed Joe Davis. I don't know if you know his work, an artist that works with genetics and DNA, and he has a residency in a lab at Harvard and MIT. And he brought me there. We talked, brought me to the both department heads, and among other things, questions I asked was because they both love him. He's an interesting guy. He's been working there for years, but he's an unpaid position. There's no funds for him at all. And the heads of both departments, and you know, these are like George Church was the head of Harvard, and these are kind of amazing people. And they were both at a loss to figure out why there is no funding for someone like an artist collaborating with scientists there. George Church said perhaps it was because it's difficult to monetize an artist's contribution, whereas if scientists are making something that's marketable, I mean, to really bring it right down to the market, that there's a lot of funding for that because it's a good investment. Do you hear that, or is that part of what's going on? I mean, that's what I knew of that world.
Yeah, I think the thing that I've been finding, and this is just, you know, one opinion, there are many out there, is that there are a lot of sides to this story. That on the one hand, the STEM folks don't want to see their funding going to projects that aren't rigorous, I guess might be the right word. And so that's their concern. And then people in the art world who aren't part of the art science and technology track, I think, worry that it's defining artists to be a certain kind of, you know, marketable, you know, science type of person rather than the kind of fluidity and other avenues that a lot of artists follow.
Mm-hmm.
And, yes, it's complicated.
Yes, it is. Well, that's why it's interesting to talk to you about this also. And in this interview, there'll be links to papers and as well as, I hope, images of your art. And I want to talk a little bit about your own art now, because you're also, of course, looking at all of this through the lens of an artist. And so in terms of your work, can we talk about it in terms of your writing and all your other work? Is there an element in your work that is also, so much of it seems to be about space and sometimes illusion of space? Is there a direct component in your work that has to do with a kind of neurology or perception? So just correct me if I'm wrong and say, oh, you're totally wrong, Painter, because I'm that's kind of what I'm seeing in it. But
No. I think it's perceptive of you. I don't really write about the things that I think about in my artwork. I know that seems strange. It makes me seem like like I have a lot of identities in parallel. but my artwork, the whole spatial and intuitive thing, is related to the brain, and that was part of how I got involved in these kinds of studies, because it didn't seem that anyone was talking about the kind of intuitive practice that I brought to the studies in my artwork at the time when I first started writing about things that resonated with me. And so I find that reading about it informs how I look at the artwork, but it really doesn't influence it, if that makes any sense.
It does make sense, because the art isn't academic, right? The art is something quite different. I mean, if that makes sense, because there are spheres of your life, which maybe you're saying sound like they're separate, but that are more academic, whereas art making really isn't academic. Would you agree with that?
Precisely. You hit it right on the head. It sometimes is insightful. Actually, what I find most insightful is that I do something in my studio that really makes sense to me. And then afterwards, I might read something academic that explains what I did. But they're not really related in the sense that if I had read the paper, I don't think I would have done it in my studio. It just happened that I started looking for something that people study in labs as well. And so, I collaborate sometimes with a man who's a vision scientist. And it's interesting to look at art together, because he'll show me things in the art that maybe I wouldn't have seen on my own.
How do you collaborate with him? How does that collaboration work?
Well, we collaborate mostly on academic projects. We actually wrote a paper on space and art many years ago, because I used to use a lot of patterning in my work. When I first met him, it was weird, because I realized that he was studying the kind of patterning that I used in my work, but I was just doing it intuitively. We developed more of an intellectual collaboration. Excuse me, but with any friendship or relationship or whatever, you learn to see things differently when you see them through other people's eyes. And so, just hanging around together, I'm sure that it changes my artwork, because, you get introduced to new ideas and new ways of thinking about things, like perspective. I don't know if you ever got interested in perspective.
Sure.
Paintings. Like if you stand on a certain place on the floor when you look at a picture or something, it's a lot more three-dimensional than if you just look at it from a random position. And I never really appreciated it until, he would always insist that I needed to stand right here when I looked at the picture to get the full resonance. So even though it's, not a dynamic way of looking at art, it's interesting to see how much, an inch or two can change your relationship with a painting.
That's very interesting. And so in closing, it's been wonderful talking to you, and I can't wait for that book to come out. When will that book come out, and is there anything else that people should be looking for? There will be links in here to some of your published papers and your other books. But so just two questions. When will that book be coming out, roughly, and is there anything else you want to say about that project?
The book should be out early next year, I think. I don't have a finished date, you know, a final date right now. People are certainly welcome to drop me an email if they have any questions. Other than that, I don't know that I have much to add, other than thank you for inviting me.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.